The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Pippa Carrera.
I believe a deal is achievable, and now is the time to make it happen.
Another EU summit comes and goes. This time, Theresa May tells the EU she would consider extending the Brexit transition period by a year. But a November summit is cleared from the diary as Brussels declares that not enough progress has been made. And the underlying equation remains the same: a split Conservative Party, no majority in the Commons, and an EU27 in no mood for compromise. Also this week, American voters go to the polls for the first time since electing Donald Trump. Will they swing back towards the Democrats?
There is a fierce anti-Trump backlash, and that's been a real problem for Republican candidates in the House and Senate and for governorships in these midterms.
So another Brexit milestone comes and goes. Theresa May returns home from the latest EU summit without a deal. But talks will continue as France and Germany reveal they're drawing up their own contingency plans for a no-deal Brexit, a scenario that becomes ever more likely with every passing week. Joining me to discuss it all, down the line, The Guardian's Brussels correspondent Jennifer Rankin and two think tank experts here in the studio, Artie Shankar of Open Europe and Jonathan Liss from British Influence. Jennifer, did Theresa May arrive in Brussels with anything new to say?
No, nothing new at all. And EU leaders were very clear on that. They didn't hear anything new from her, but although I don't think they were expecting to. But they have said now there hasn't been enough progress in the Brexit talks. And as a result, they haven't agreed to set a date for a summit in November. And they've really given the UK an instruction to go back into the negotiating room led by Michel Barnier and his team. And only then, once there is decisive progress, if and when there is that progress, then a future summit will be called. So they're really putting the pressure back on to Theresa May and saying the ball is in your court.
And Jennifer, Theresa May's tried to go over the heads of the EU Commission negotiators in the past and appeal directly to the other leaders. I mean, over the summer, she embarked on a furious round of diplomacy around Europe. Do you think there's any sign that this will eventually be where the deal is done?
I don't get that impression at the moment. I think what's been very interesting about this summit is how far it has confirmed the role of Michel Barnier as the essential person in this process. And EU leaders said last night they reaffirmed that he is their chief negotiator. He is the man they want to do this deal. And many of them, they're just not on top of the details because, of course, this is a hugely complex negotiation with very sort of nitty-gritty, difficult points on customs and the single market and all sorts of areas. And they don't have the details at their fingertips. Michel Barnier and his team do, and they want him to continue that negotiation. And it's really quite remarkable to me how much trust there is in Barnier and his team to carry out this negotiation. And you find actually EU ambassadors and therefore ministers are not so on top of the details, but they really are putting a lot of trust in Barnier to sort this out.
And Artie, there's some speculation that this has all just been a cynical exercise by the government to avoid committing to anything concrete before what could be a tricky vote on the budget.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of speculation about whether or not this is a theatre. So is Prime Minister Theresa May going there? Was Sunday an attempt to go and say, no, we're standing very firm on our lines, we're not going to back down, we understand the DUP's concerns, we understand the Conservative and Unionist Party's concerns, and we're not going to give in to the idea of an NI-only, Northern Ireland-only backstop proposal? But was that done as kind of grandstanding and in the knowledge that they can then point to that and say, well, we fought very, very hard, but otherwise we're not going to get a deal, so we're going to have to compromise here and it's going to be us? I think that's perhaps not the case. I think really everyone is working extremely hard to try and find some common ground here. The idea that has been thrown in the air of an extension to the transition, of potentially considering the UK's temporary customs arrangement that would apply to the UK as a whole, the idea that these are coming out now as solutions to help us sell the backstop or to help us consider the backstop in a kind of wider scenario, that suggests to me that actually, you know, we are working very hard, we are getting to a point where there is a path through, and we just keep coming up against obstacles at this point in the process.
But it is true, of course, that May has tread a very careful path towards keeping her own backbenchers happy.
Yes, and I think we're seeing just how fine a line that is with the suggestion of the extension of a transition. So very clearly there are Conservative MPs on both sides of this issue who voted Leave and who voted Remain who are saying, well, we're not entirely sure that that's a palatable suggestion. And the question will be, if Theresa May really wants to sell that to her party and to Parliament, she's going to have to signal something that she got in return for doing that.
And Jonathan, do you think these talks are well and truly stuck now, or is there any evidence of a gradual shift on either side?
Well, I suppose the answer to that is both are true. The idea that May now saying that there's a possibility of extending the transition is a sign that she is budging, which she hasn't really wanted to do for a long time. But at the same time, an extension of transition is a complete red herring. It doesn't solve any of our problems. For a start, a trade deal will take 5 to 10 years to negotiate, not an extra few months that May is talking about. But the far more important issue is that it does nothing to resolve the backstop. Because this backstop is not about sort of lasting until a transition is completed and then we enter the new relationship. It's about replicating or continuing a customs union and a single market of goods in Northern Ireland, potentially in perpetuity. So when May says, oh, well, we need to extend a transition so the backstop never has to kick in, so the future relationship can take care of it, it shows a fundamental misunderstanding on her part of what the backstop actually is. It doesn't get replaced by any future relationship. He gets replaced by a future relationship that replicates a soft Brexit.
And Jennifer, how much no-deal planning in the EU and the various EU capitals is actually going on?
I think in different EU capitals, they are stepping up their no-deal planning. From the Commission next week, we can expect another no-deal paper setting out how how Brussels officials are trying to centralise and organise that no-deal planning. They had actually delayed that paper. It was due to be published last week, but they thought it would send the wrong signal at a very sensitive moment in the Brexit negotiations, so they held that over. But now they're going to publish it, and we've seen various other national capitals stepping up their no-deal planning, notably in France, in Germany. In France, the government has published a bill on what it's doing across a whole range of areas, from hiring more customs officers to warning that there could be consequences for British nationals living in France, and also even the possibility of visas being required if no agreements or arrangements were put in place. So I think preparations are definitely moving forward, and that was a message that ministers have delivered to the Commission also this week, that they really want to see that step up a gear now with a lot of uncertainty about the talks and whether there will be an agreement with the UK.
And Artie, if this is brinkmanship, are we simply not close enough to the edge of the cliff for either side to blink yet?
Yes, I think you can argue that really what we have to get done in the 5 months that's remaining is not simply reach an agreement at negotiator level or political level between the UK and the EU. This then needs to pass through the parliamentary process here, which is not quick and simple. We have to pass legislation as well as getting Parliament to vote on this. It has to go through the European Parliament, but the European Parliament have suggested that they could do that in a relatively quick time frame. And I think we saw this very clearly on Sunday. It's not simply a matter of agreeing that in the negotiating room that we're at. We need to sell that back here. And the sounds coming from the member states, certainly after yesterday's summit, was very much a concern about the political environment here. Even if we agree something with the EU, can it be passed domestically?
Mm-hmm. And of course, we got wind this week of a rather curious letter from Dominic Raab about the procedural terms of the final vote on the deal. Can you explain what's going on here?
Well, it seems to be that the government is standing on its position that what it wants to do is present a motion in neutral terms, is how it's phrased, i.e. it's going to get Parliament to vote either yes or no to the final agreement that it gets with the EU. It doesn't want Parliament, it appears, and interpret the letter. It's implicit in the letter rather than explicit, but it seems to be that it doesn't want Parliament to make too many amendments or any amendments to the motion, and therefore it will be a matter of saying to Parliament, okay, well, we've negotiated this deal, are you going to stand with it? And if you aren't, you're saying no deal. That seems to be the position that they want to put Parliament in, and you know, there are questions about the democraticness of that, but equally the time frame in which we're doing this doesn't really leave a lot of time for amendments, for renegotiation with the EU. This is all an incredibly compressed timetable. So Parliament likely is going to face a question of our deal, slightly changed if possible, or no deal.
And Jennifer, from a European perspective, what happens now? What happens when they all pack up their bags and go home from this summit?
Well, I think they will wait for the negotiations to resume again. We haven't had a sign yet when those negotiations will restart again. So the talks led by the Commission's Task Force 50 on one side and Ollie Robbins on the other side for the UK. But we expect they will start again very soon and that the EU will be looking for more progress on that. Inevitably, it will come down to the question of the Irish backstop. We may also have more discussion about the transition. But I don't think EU leaders will be getting involved in this process. And it was interesting to see that, for example, the Prime Minister of Luxembourg, Xavier Bettel, said yesterday, well, we're not going to come for a summit just to have some shortbread and a cup of tea. We want something really meaningful. I mean, EU sources will often stress, you know, every single country has their own domestic politics. They have a lot going on in November. And it's such a packed month that they don't want to make the trip to Brussels unless there really has been a breakthrough, and that will come through the negotiating in Brussels. And as I said, Michel Barnier will be the judge of that. So it gives him a very powerful role in this process.
And Jonathan, the next time the European leaders will meet will be in December at their summit. What happens here in the UK up until that point?
Well, hopefully a lot of soul searching and a little bit less delusion. I think people just need to finally be honest at the 11th hour or 5 minutes to midnight even about what this process entails and what actually Theresa May signed up to last December in the backstop. Now, Michael Gove, who's not a stupid man, and Boris Johnson and others have been falling over themselves to say they didn't understand what their own government signed up to in December. Now, that is not acceptable. This idea that there's still no comprehensive, unified government position at the end of the negotiations is unprecedented in its level of incompetence. They have to understand the text that was quite clear in December, which spelled out the Northern Ireland would have to abide by the rules of the customs union and by the rules of the single market and goods in order to preserve an open and invisible border in Ireland. Now, if the UK wants to have a border in the Irish Sea, that's not anyone's first choice, but it's not a matter for the EU, it's a matter for the UK. The EU is insisting on this backstop. And ultimately, that means that Theresa May was absolutely right in her conference speech when she identified the choices that the EU has given her. Either we have a full soft Brexit of a full single market and customs union for the whole UK, or there is some kind of border in the Irish Sea, either for customs or regulations or both.
Jennifer, you're out there at the summit and got all the European leaders and their officials jostling around. What's the atmosphere there like? Do you get the impression that people feel that a deal will finally be reached, even if it's not just now?
I think the money is on a deal because it usually is. But I've never seen such uncertainty about the final results. Even if I think back to something like the Greek financial crisis, when we were sort of bouncing from one summit to another summit, one emergency meeting to another, that there was a lot of uncertainty there. But I think here it's playing out in a slower way, but with even more uncertainty, and people really don't know how the British government, how Theresa May is going to handle this process. They don't know in which direction she's going to move or whether a deal could get through the House of Commons. So, I mean, I think people are avidly watching British politics, but feeling like it's not their place to get involved, and they really want to keep out of it. And they're trying to do everything they can also to not inflame the situation. I think after Salzburg, there was a sense of regret that ended in such conflict, and they didn't want to create that atmosphere again. So people have been really treading on eggshells in their public statements, the EU leaders, diplomats, to stress very much that they do want a deal, but of course not at any price.
So Artie, the ball is very much back in Theresa May's court. She obviously has a huge problem ahead with parliamentary arithmetic though, doesn't she?
Yes, and I think this will depend on what she brings back on the backstop. So if she brings back the EU's backstop in its current form, i.e. that Northern Ireland alone remains in the EU's customs territory and the EU's regulatory territory, then I think she has an extremely difficult time passing that in Parliament, because she stood up and said her party has very much held the view that that's not acceptable. Labour holds the view that that's not acceptable. The DUP obviously will not accept that. So how she gets that through the domestic political process is extremely difficult to see. If she comes back, however, with a backstop that is UK-wide on customs, but Northern Ireland-wide on regulatory, well, then it'd be interesting to see how that falls, because I think she could potentially, and this is a big if, get the DUP on side if she manages to say, okay, so it might look formally slightly different, but we are going to align similarly with the single market regulations so that you don't have to worry. You don't actually look different to us. And the way in which we enforce those checks, they will be done at our ports and we will be in control of that. And really, they won't be there at all. Well, then maybe she can get the DUP on board. That's a very tricky situation, and I would say a lot of this rests on the DUP.
And Jonathan, I've spoken to lots of EU officials who say, look, really, it's impossible. How can we negotiate with the UK when the UK government's still negotiating with itself? Isn't it time finally for May to face down her own party critics?
I think it's time for her to face down her party critics and also the DUP. I mean, what Artie was saying just now, I agree that was the deal that was sort of on the table last week, that the whole UK would be in the customs union, so Northern Ireland wouldn't be exempt from UK trade deals, for example, which would have been a huge problem. So you have a UK customs union and a Northern Ireland single market in goods. Now, where I disagree is that the DUP would ever swallow that, because Arlene Foster has basically staked her entire sort of, you know, identity, if you like, and certainly her career on there being no increased checks between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. So what May really has to do is face down the DUP and say, well, there will have to be some checks. And if you don't like it, then what are you going to do about it? Because there are potentially some Labour MPs in Leave seats who would see that deal with the customs union and, you know, sort of a de-dramatised, so to speak, Irish sea border and vote for that. So that's May's trade-off.
And so already a few of those Labour MPs have gone on the record and said that they would consider what they viewed as a sensible Brexit deal, voting with the government. Are there enough of them, though, to balance out the DUP should the DUP not back the government?
So I think
government?
That's a really tricky calculation, because I think if the government loses the DUP, well, then her position with her Conservative backbench MPs from the ERG group gets very, very tricky, because they can very easily look at that and say, well, no, if we can, we have to stand by our unionist colleagues. We are doing this for the union. This isn't about us being hardline Brexiteers wanting any old agreement, wanting a WTO agreement with the EU. This is about us saying we're doing this because we believe in our precious, precious union. And that gets very, very difficult, I think, for the Prime Minister. She shouldn't underestimate the power that the DUP has in knock-on effect as well. And the other thing I would say about facing the DUP down is that it is of concern to all unionist parties in Northern Ireland. This isn't just about the DUP. And I think that is the key obstacle that the EU's backstop faces, is that if it is intended to preserve the stability of the peace process in Northern Ireland and to preserve that fine balance of the two identities in Northern Ireland, well, if all unionists are saying, we cannot handle this backstop, we do not think this backstop is acceptable, it damages our identity, well, then you have a real problem. You haven't succeeded.
And this is exactly the crunch, actually, that May is going to have to confront her own unionism at some point, because you're absolutely right that sort of, you know, the both sides, you know, both communities in Northern Ireland have very, very strong allegiances, and the only way of resolving this is to have a UK-wide solution for everything, and that means Norway plus customs union. The moment May is saying, effectively, that she would rather block migration rights for Polish plumbers than have the whole UK economic integrity. And that is a position, but she has to be clear on what that means.
Well, I'm not sure that's entirely true. If you look at what the EU's proposed on the backstop, it's not proposed Norway for Northern Ireland. It's proposed single market in goods for Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
So if it thinks that is agreeable in principle for Northern Ireland, and it can have a variety of concerns about how this about the economic damage it would do to make this UK wide, but in principle then it is possible UK wide.
Absolutely.
It need not be Norway plus customs union for the UK. It could be single market in goods plus customs union for the UK, which is very similar to Chequers.
It's very similar to Chequers, and that's why the EU can never agree to it. So it comes down to politics in the end. Northern Ireland gets a bespoke solution because of peace and the Good Friday Agreement. The UK cannot have its cake and eat it. The EU has been saying for the last 2 years, if you want single market in goods, you need to get free movement of people as well. They are not going to back down now and say you can have Chequers after all.
Well, you can continue to follow all our reporting on Brexit at theguardian.com. Now, in just over 2 weeks' time, American voters will all go to the polls for the first time since they elected Donald Trump to the presidency in 2016. The US midterms on November 6th see all the seats in the House of Representatives up for grabs and a third of the Senate. Both are currently controlled by the Republicans. Joining me on the line from our Washington, D.C. office is our Bureau Chief David Smith. David, are these elections essentially a referendum on Trump's presidency so far?
In many ways, yes, and that's probably true. With every midterm election, it's always a referendum on the sitting president. But as ever with Donald Trump, everything is always magnified and in a way that we probably haven't quite seen before. It seems every local race becomes nationalized, and Trump is a presence always to be debated, and is a candidate for him or against him. We've seen him featuring a lot in the debates and in the advertising, and it's probably going to be anti-Trump enthusiasm that powers a lot of Democratic candidates that they're quite likely to win the House of Representatives, at least. And you know, we saw it a day after Trump's inauguration with the Women's March in Washington and in other cities. We've seen it in all sorts of ways. There is a fierce anti-Trump backlash, and that's been a real problem for Republican candidates in the House and Senate and for governorships in these midterms.
And to what extent has he personally got involved in the election race?
Again, probably more than past presidents. Trump has been personally involved in this. There's nothing he loves more than election campaigning and holding these mass rallies where he throws out red meat chunks of populism and whips up the crowd. So he has really hurled himself into the midterms campaign. There's been many rallies. There are many more rallies to come. It's as if he's reliving his 2016 presidential election run again. He's given numerous interviews, one in which he said, you know, if Republicans lose, it's not his fault. But at the same time, he's weighing in regularly with endorsements of certain candidates on Twitter, to talking about the thing constantly. And some would suspect, you know, he actually enjoys this aspect of politics much more than getting national security briefings or day-to-day business at the White House.
And you mentioned the House of Representatives. What would it mean in practical terms for the Democrats to win that back?
If Democrats win the House, then finally there is some sort of check on Donald Trump's power, because you know, right now the Republicans have everything, the White House, the Senate and the House of Representatives. And if Democrats have the House, they can try to push legislation, although it will probably be blocked by the Republican Senate, but they can certainly stop some of Trump's plans for legislation. Too late, of course, to stop his tax cuts, but they would certainly be able to curb his ambitions on healthcare. And perhaps most strikingly, Democrats in the House would really be able to bombard the Trump administration with subpoenas and committee hearings and investigations. They would be able to focus attention on Trump's alleged collusion with Russia in 2016, other financial irregularities as they see it. People have suggested that if you thought the past 2 years were crazy and combative and not much got done in Washington, just wait to see what happens if Democrats have the House and can you know, wield that influence on Trump.
And ultimately impeachment? I mean, is that something that's on the cards?
Impeachment is an interesting debate. Certainly, if Democrats had control of the House, then it would become a much stronger theoretical possibility. The Democratic leadership are really playing that down, at least for now, because they suspect it would actually rally Trump supporters during these midterms, and just the mere threat of impeachment could encourage Trump supporters to turn out. There are some Democrats who are keen on it and would push for it, but this is really why control of the Senate is also crucial. If Democrats only have the House, but Republicans still control the Senate, as polls suggest right now, then
is there any chance that they could win the Senate?
There's a chance, but the polling suggests in the last couple of weeks that chance has receded. There was a lot of optimism for Democrats for a while, but the reality just of the way the map falls this year is that most of the Senate contests are happening in the Trump heartland, red states that voted for him heavily in 2016. And right now the poll suggests Republicans will retain control or perhaps even slightly expand control. And so you'll have a split government with a Republican Senate and a Democratic House. And if Republicans have the Senate, then they could block moves to impeach Donald Trump.
It sounds like this is still a country badly divided.
Very divided, and you see it play out every day in the news media, in culture, in politics, in just the hyper-partisan mood that prevails. It's very hard to get anything done in Washington, and any simple story seems to break down along partisan lines. And in recent months, we've seen flashpoints in the so-called culture wars, whether it's African-American football players taking the knee during the national anthem in protest, or more recently, of course, and explosively, the Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh going to the confirmation hearing where he was accused of sexual assault when he was a teenager by Dr. Christine Blasey Ford. And that was really the most striking and ugly reminder of the partisanship that we saw as that played out over several weeks. And that may feed into this election and fire up both sides even more. And as you'll have heard, just those two examples, one a bitter divide over race, another a bitter divide over gender. You really right now have a lot of conversations where one side is not listening to the other.
David Smith there in Washington, D.C. And you can follow all our reporting on the US midterms in the run-up to the vote on theguardian.com. Well, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to David Smith, Artie Shankar, Jonathan Liss and Jennifer Rankin. The producers were Simon Barnard and Phil Maynard. I'm Pippa Carrera. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.